You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
Well, hello and welcome to the 602 Club, TFM's local watering hole. And this week we're coming at you from our Metropolis office, and we're so excited to be here. Yes, that's right. I call the bar an office because, well, you know, when you take drinking as seriously as we do, and as movies and television, well, it's definitely a job. And I'm just one of your hosts here, Matthew Rushing. I'm so excited to have back with me my good friend and podcast partner over on Aggressive Negotiations, as well as Superman fan, John Mills. John, goodness, it's just great to have you back here in the 602 Club.
Well, since we're in the Metropolis office, I figured I'd bring in this special plaque with the engraving, "Sobriety is my kryptonite." So I figure you can hang that over my booth. So
perfect, perfect.
Yes.
Well, you know, hopefully you're not getting texts from your ex, Eve, while we podcast, or at least just, you know, turn the dinger off your phone.
She wouldn't have been my ex, but okay.
But you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Of course, if you're enjoying the show, share it with a friend. One of the best ways to grow a podcast audience is actually just to recommend it to a friend. You can also do that on social media. You can follow us over on X, Twitter, at the 602 Club. We're on Instagram at the 602 Club TFM. You can also find us online with the entire network at trek.fm, plus on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, the listeners-only discussion group, so you can talk about what's going on here on the network. And our hosting site, Facebook, the group is called the Babel Conference. Of course, you can join us there. And if you like what we're doing, please go over to Patreon at patreon.com/trekfm and help us out. Make sure we can keep all of these shows coming to you. But John, all of that preamble out of the way, we got to jump in because we are talking about Superman from 2025, directed by James Gunn, the very first movie that we're getting in the new DCU as we are relaunching the DC universe. And I just wanted to talk a little bit with you about this idea of, you know, this has had a kind of a long creative hell, and both you and I, having done Snyder Cuts, gone through all of those films again. And, you know, we're in the know in the sense of, like, we read the trades. We see what's going on with movies. And this whole thing, the reformatting of the DC universe after it kind of imploded because, you know, I mean, honestly,
reasons.
Warner Brothers stuck its nose in where it should have just let things happen and tried to make something that it wasn't. All that stuff. So just kind of coming into this, I did just want to, we don't really have to talk about necessarily, you know, all that happened. People can go look it up. You know, anybody listening to this show probably knows a lot of the behind the scenes work. But I just wanted to ask you, where did that kind of leave you just coming into this film with this? I mean, we kept hearing, right? Oh, well, we're going to redo, are we going to do a Man of Steel sequel? And you know, Black Adam came out and, you know, Henry Cavill was in that and he announced that he was going to be back as Superman. And then, you know, it's just like so many times we're getting our hopes up and then things just got dashed. And so how did that have any impact for you coming into this film, or were you just ready to be like, all right, we got a clean slate, let's see what happens?
Yeah, definitely the latter. Because, you know, I mean, ultimately all that behind the scenes stuff doesn't amount to a hill of beans, right? I would have loved to see Cavill get another shot at it. That's great.
Same. Yeah.
But, you know, it's one of those things where, in all honesty, paying attention to the trades and stuff like that, it's just important to remember, I think people lose sight of this, it's always been this way in Hollywood. It's always been this push and pull. It's always been that, like, Batman 1989, the you know, revitalized everything more than a decade after the first Superman launched the idea of a comic book movie being something you could do. And then that was in development hell for a long time. But I mean, casting problems, people complained, blah, 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 didn't amount to hill of beans. All that matters at the end of the day is what comes out and whether, you know, do audiences like it or not. And so it's like, for me, I just, I don't know anybody who, does anybody actually care? Like when the movie comes out, I mean, I guess to your point with the wars in the fandom, there are people still holding a grudge, I guess, but you know, whatever. Right. But yeah, I, for me, I mean, were you carrying that? Because the thing is, look, let's speak brass tacks here. You, you've been the Snyder fan from the get-go, right? Yes. You've been the defender of the Snyderverse since the beginning. You would, like in your dream universe, the Snyderverse is it. It kept going. And Zack Snyder got to keep implementing his vision out through everywhere. Where did it leave you is the question coming into this. Like, where were you with it?
Yeah, you know, I appreciate you asking. And I was obviously frustrated because, like you said, I was definitely a fan of the Snyderverse from the beginning. I responded, you know, very well to Man of Steel. I thought it was a fantastic interpretation, and it was new, right? Like, and we've talked about it, obviously, anybody can go back and listen to Snyder Cuts, where, you know, you ended up coming around to those films, you know, after time. You know, I can even remember you completely, you know, trashing Batman v Superman in a review that I legitimately wanted to come to your house and burn your car.
Now, as a qualifier, so. That review of the theatrical the view of the theatrical cut that I espoused back then stands. I only ever defend the Ultimate Edition. Let's be clear about this, okay?
Yes. So, but yeah, I mean, I think that the thing for me in this was. Whereas I loved the Snyderverse. I mean, you know, and the fact that we actually got the Snyder cut of Justice League, which I thought was brilliant, was really well done. By the time it ended, right, that universe was such a mess, and really it had come down to for me is that the studio had interfered, and so to know that they were like. And this was the thing. This is what I found really interesting. Zaslav comes in and he basically does something that should have been done a long time ago, which is like Marvel, he put one person in charge of all of DC. You know, James Gunn is the head of DC Studios now. There, it's not Warner Brothers, it's DC Studios. And so he gets to make the creative decisions. They've got Peter Safran there to help with the business decisions. You know, basically Safran is playing that kind of like Kathy Kennedy role that she used to play where she's the producer, making sure all that stuff happens. And so having just one creative vision then that everything's going to flow through, I think in some ways was smart. And so I'm, you know, I haven't loved everything that James Gunn has done. I'm on record of not really loving, you know, his Suicide Squad. But I've liked other things that he's done. You know, the Guardians films grew on me immensely. And I think they're some of the actual best films of the MCU. Very consistent, really well done. The production value is fantastic. And part of that is James Gunn is a director who he knows what he wants. And he gets it done, right? And so... all of that left me to the place where I was like, okay, we're going to jump in and I'm good with this. Really, it just comes down to, I hope I like the movie, right? And so now starting with Superman here, you know, Dan Didio, who used to run DC Comics back in the day, was their executive editor and co-publisher at that point and for 18 years. You know, he said this idea that if Superman's working, the feeling from the audience for DC is that DC itself is working. And so Do you feel like that this was the right choice to start with Superman to kind of launch this universe? Do you feel like that was the way to go?
Yes, I think it's the right way to go because Superman is the character that, to the point you just made, has to set the tone for everything. He's your true north. Who is your most extremely good person? It's going to be Superman. And if you nail that, okay, I know who my extreme, like, if I'm looking at the scale of good to evil and it's a linear course, Superman's on the good end. Who's on the bad end? Luther always starts out on the bad end, and then we keep stretching the bad end out. But Superman's the anchor. So I agree with that. If you start with Batman, you start in a dark place. And Batman's always the moral equivocator. Superman's supposed to be, I'm making the right choice regardless of the situation. I'm going to make the right choice, period. And so he's your true north.
Yeah.
I think, though, that the way you establish Superman is trickier now because you can no longer establish a comic book character in a vacuum in an easy way. I will go back to the Batman. That demonstrate, I think, honestly, if you look at the Batman and then you look at this Superman, you see the exact difficulty that a comic book universe, quote unquote, has. You either have to commit that this is your only hero that exists, or you have to introduce it and say, okay, I have to give you the whole spectrum of everything. So,
yeah.
Was Superman necessary to be the one to lead the way? I think just as a tone setter, yeah, I do.
I love the way you said that Superman becomes the tone setter. I think that is really key. And part of that, you know, I mean, legitimately comes down to the fact that Superman is the tone setter for all of comics because he is the original superhero and has set the tone since he began. And I think, you know, you and I have both read comics on and off for the years that we've been alive, right? And in each kind of iteration of the DC universe that they've been in at that point, right, Superman definitely has a different feel, and again, he's kind of setting the tone for that universe depending on who's writing it. I mean, you know, you think of in the 80s when John Byrne comes in, completely revamps the Superman line, gives him a new baseline for his origin story and all that. You know, you think of then something like the New 52 does the same thing, right? And so, yeah, I think you're really on target with saying that about starting with Superman. And I think, this is the other thing, and this actually might be where I think, you know, James Gunn is actually helpful for this, which is he is so good at making minor characters major characters.
Yeah.
And so his big challenge here was, can I make the most major character the major character? And really, like you said, in that then set the tone for the universe we're creating. And you know, I think we'll talk about whether or not we feel like he did that, but that I feels like, you know, that's really the challenge for him and this new DCU in the first place.
Yeah, I agree. To speak to your point about the minor characters working and stuff like that, you know, as we move forward here, I'm going to put a little pin in this. We can always come back to it or whatever. But my wife saw this with me. That's a statement in and of itself of how important Superman is to setting the tone. She hasn't come with me to a Batman movie. I mean, she saw Dark Knight Rises with me, but then when the Batman came out, she's like, eh, I'm good.
Yeah.
And she was like, oh, there's a Superman movie? Yeah, I'll go with you. Like, that's a treat for me. And so that's point number one. Point number two is that she has no idea who the hell Guy Gardner is.
Yeah.
And she still called him out as one of her favorite parts of the movie. So to speak to Gunn's ability to set up side characters, that, I mean, it's huge. Yep. She's a normal. She doesn't even know anything about the Green Lantern Corps. What the hell does she care? Right? She just knows silly haircut, good character, enjoyed him. And so, like, those are your three checkboxes.
Yes. No, I mean, It's interesting that you mentioned that because, like, we've been friends for years now. We've podcasted for years now. And the amount of times that your wife specifically has wanted to go to a movie with you that we have been watching for the 602 Club or anything else.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, I feel like I could count on one hand the amount of times in the last, like, 12 years that's happened.
Yes.
And so what I think that does speak absolute volumes for the fact that Superman, if you do him right, still has an incredible pull, right? Because of the character. I mean, next to the cross of Jesus Christ, the most recognizable symbol in the world is the Superman shield. And so, yeah, I mean, getting this right is really important. So one of the things that we kind of need to do a bit of history with here, because this film has a bit of history up front, because the movie literally drops you in.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and so we are being pulled into a comic book universe the same way as a kid you might just pick up an issue of Superman off the old spinner racks back in the day. You don't know if you're in the middle of a story or not, right? You're just picking it up. That's kind of how this begins. And so I wanted to ask you about the fact that James Gunn, it's not a crawl like Star Wars, but it has that similar feel where it is bringing you up to speed with where you are in the story.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you feel like, you know, that kind of in media res worked?
I go back and forth, but yeah, the picking up a comic off the shelf, this is a trade paperback, I've missed previous issues, it throws me in. I'm either going to buy in at the start or I'm not. And I opted to buy in, obviously. And I think it's also, I think honestly, it speaks to origin story fatigue. Nobody wants to see the origin story anymore. We've seen it 1,000 times. Like, the first time you saw Superman's origin story on screen or on videotape, depending, you were like, wow, this is his origin story. But even Batman in 1989 didn't tell the story of what happened to his parents until deep into the movie.
Yeah,
and it was one
exactly.
scene. And so when we then had to reboot stuff, and we would have to keep revisiting origin stories. And honestly, you know who I'll throw under the bus for this is Spider-Man. We all turned it into a meme of Uncle Ben with the line under it, how many times do I have to die?
Yeah.
It's like, why do I have to watch, you know, because they've rebooted the series so quickly that I was like, oh yeah, we get it. Uncle Ben, good Lord, enough already. So the emotional impact of it for us as an audience is blunted. So this, I honestly think this is just Gunn smartly declaring at the beginning, I know you're tired of origin stories. We're just going to jump into this, and I'm declaring it. And I think it's ultimately the right call because it lets you get to the action faster. That's what works with Star Wars. The original Star Wars, boom, you're off to the races.
Yep.
And that's why people came down on episode one. I remember several of the reviews came down on episode one when that came out because they were like, where it didn't start in the middle of the action. Yeah, there's a ship traveling somewhere, but there's not a big action scene right after the crawl. And I think that, this is smart. It's going to capture the audience and get them off to the races.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things I think he does is basically build a universe in 30 seconds, you know,
right.
which is to say, hey, this world that we're visiting, this Earth has 300 years of metahuman experience now. You know, Superman's been here for 30 years, and now 3 years from that, he's been announced as Superman, and he's kind of the strongest hero of them all, and we're going to throw you right into that story because 3 minutes ago, Superman just got his butt kicked for the first time, you know, which I think in a lot of ways, it sets the stage for everything you need to know. And everything else about this movie, whether they explain it or not to you about who this character is really or what their origin story is or, you know, all that, it's like, to me, and I don't want to jump too far ahead of myself, but I think one of the things that this film does really well is actually utilize every other character to be a juxtaposition to Superman so that every character is about exploring a side of who Clark is as opposed to who other people are, which is what makes him special then compared to everybody else. And to me, that's the thing I think, you know, going into this, I have to say, I was definitely afraid there were going to be too many characters and there was going to be too much stuff happening. And what I felt like as I watched the film is that every single thing was actually helping me see a reflection of who Clark is and Superman is by seeing who he's not in these other characters and really making, you know, again, him shine more because of that.
Yeah, I could see that. I think the movie does struggle a little bit with too many characters. I think that that is one of its struggles. But I think that what alleviates it in a large sense is it moves very quickly. I think Gunn, to your point, Gunn knows what he wants. You don't have long enough of a time to have a problem with something before you've moved on to something else. And, you know, in a sense, it's like all of the great, like old Lucas and Spielberg and Donner stuff where it's like you don't have time to complain about it. You're just on to the next thing. And it's like, oh, okay, well, all right. Well, I'll think about that later. And then you're having fun again. But I think that the number of characters does present a little bit of a hurdle. I think not so much with Superman. Yes, a little bit with Superman, but more with Luther, because I think Luther's arc gets a little staccato as a result. And I would have liked to have a little bit more breathing space for the Luther character to turn that more into an arc and give him more of an opportunity to ramp up to the insanity instead of start out at the insanity and then just basically just like stay it ramped up to 11 the whole way. It's like I would have liked to see that warm up a little bit more.
Sure. No, I think that's actually really astute and perfect to be able to kind of jump into Lex and his plans within plans. And so, you know, with Nicholas Holt taking on the role of Lex Luthor, famously, he had actually did an audition for Superman. And of course, they cast him as Lex instead. Performance-wise, just what did you think of him as the character? And did he do a good job of kind of inhabiting this incredibly amoral, you know, I don't even know if psychopath is the right word, but just such an amoral, I don't even know how else to describe him. You know, I mean, he's just a turd face, really, right?
I think Holt is great. I think Holt understood the assignment that Gunn gave him, which was, again, you're dialing it up to 12. You're going through the whole movie this way, and you are the joke I made since I saw it was, what's Lex Luthor's motivation? Yes, it is. Like, his motivation is yes. That's just what his motivation is. And you know, you say plans within plans, but there are plenty of times where you can go, wait, I thought he would, but he's okay. All right. Well, that, all right. And that's where I think, you know, that development would have helped. But I don't think any of it is Holt's fault, because I think Holt is inhabiting the character in such a way that I enjoy him in the role. And when he has his devilish moments, it's great. I just wish he'd had more of a chance to play around with it. He's very, you know, he's cut from the same cloth, honestly, as like an old James Bond villain, which is reminiscent of Gene Hackman's Lex Luthor. So he's reminiscent of that. So he's less, he's definitely way different than Snyder's approach to the character. And he's different than a lot of the TV approaches to the character.
Sure.
But he is definitely an approach to the character. And I think Holt does.
Yeah.
I think Holt does a good job with what he's asked to do.
You know, it's interesting because so much of this movie, I mean, we could really actually go through a lot of this movie and see where it actually has a lot of parallels to Batman v Superman in the ways it's dealing with Superman and the plans that Lex has. I mean, you know, the whole movie of BVS is Lex Luthor hating Superman because he can't deal with the fact that there's anybody godlike that could be good, and so he wants to destroy him, and he's going to use, you know, Batman to do it. And in this movie, very much the same motivation. It's this, like, envy and hatred of Superman because he feels inferior, and then therefore he's envious of Superman and his popularity. And so his desire is to destroy him, and he's talked himself into being, you know, a force for good in humanity because he's willing to do this when nobody else is. You know, he's got that delusional thing of like, how am I the only one who sees this, basically? And so I think, you know, in that Holt's performance is, like you said, he's always at a 12, except for those moments where it's like, you see this other, like, kind of charismatic and swarmy side when he is on television, or, you know, when he's talking
right, I wanted
to
more of that.
The Department of Defense, you know, and so.
I wanted more of that Luther. I wanted more of the Luther who shoots the guy in the head. I wanted more of that Luther because I wanted that menace structured in such a way that it built up to unhinged Luther. And you know, that's why I say it's like sort of staccato, but like I want to be the one, and I'm going to champion this, and I know that I'm the tip of the spear on this one, but I also like this Luther. Well, I'll get to it later because I'm sure we're going to talk about the Hammer of Barovia as it relates to Lex. I'll get to that. That's a little tease, folks. Stick around.
Well, so maybe it is a good time then to just kind of talk about how all of these plans connect, because, you know, Lex has created a war between these two countries, knowing that Superman will insert himself because he can't help himself. And he is hoping then to be able to utilize that to convince the American government that this alien needs to be taken down as a threat. Because, you know, he's acting, quote unquote, unilaterally, while at the same time, you know, he is publicly trashing Superman on social media with his monkey bots, which is hilarious, and, you know, creating mayhem too wherever Superman goes, kind of trying to make him look bad. Again, so much of this is so similar to BVS. While at the same time, he's created a pocket universe so that he can hold Superman there with Metamorpho, and who can create kryptonite. And he's also created a clone of Superman, also known as Ultraman, who might be dumb, but also is stronger than Superman. So Lex can basically play a video game version of Mortal Kombat with Superman and beat him as well. And just one more thing. He's created the engineer who has a nano-engineered body, which allows them then to hack into the Fortress of Solitude you know, gives us a message from Clark's parents that Lex didn't know existed at that point until he gets it. So, that's a very small, like, 45-second explanation of the plan. So, as I said, plans within plans.
It's a tough elevator pitch, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, I guess not for Lex Luthor because he is a genius, but, you know.
Yeah, you know, it's a, and that's one of those things where it's like, I think with movies, a clear linear plan is a lot easier to communicate to the audience and a lot easier to process in your popcorn movie. And I think that is where the movie doesn't do itself a lot of favors, because you have to stop every so often. You're like, wait, how does this? Okay, right. That plugs into this way. That plugs into that way. But again, it's told quickly enough that, you know, you're not doing homework in your head necessarily. It's afterward. You're like, okay, so how did that all go together? Okay, it goes together like that. Okay, cool. So I'll go ahead and Ultraman, I consider, and I'll be tip of the spear on this, I won't be the last one to say this. I want to corner James Gunn, and I want to ask him, was that a reference to Superman 4, because if you hear the line about how he created the clone of Superman, it was from a strand of hair. And the one of the parts of Superman 4 is he uses a strand of hair to create Nuclear Man, who's kind of a clone of Superman, who's not the brightest guy in the world, but is as powerful as Superman. I will die on this hill. It's a Superman 4 reference. James Gunn, if you're out there, Jimmy, you can tell the people if I'm wrong or not, but I know I'm not. I know I'm correct on that one.
No, I can't imagine that you are wrong, honestly, because
words that warm my heart. I love it.
Yeah, James Gunn knows his comic book stuff, right? And he knows these films inside and out as well. And so, I think the beautiful thing about this movie in some ways is that it actually rewards you for watching the movie more than once, because the plan you know what's coming, and then you can see how it actually all connects. And it actually does connect. Like it's so many people I've seen come out of this and feel as though it's like messy, or the plot is non-existent. And honestly, I heartily disagree with that. I do not think that is the case. I think that this movie clearly has a plot, and so does Lex against Superman. And basically, what it seems like is Lex has just created all these contingency plans, right? Mm-hmm. So that if one thing kind of fails, he has another one. And again, very similar to the exact same thing that the Lex from the Snyderverse did. You know, he had contingency plans for if things didn't work out. And his last contingency, of course, is Doomsday at the end, which, you know, killed Superman. And we don't get that far into this. But that's what basically Lex would have loved to do in this film. Like, his goal was basically to either lock Superman in a pocket universe forever or to be able to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I mean, I think that, to me, it was all interesting, and it worked. And I did get a chance to see the movie a few times. And I'm every time I've seen it, I've enjoyed it, actually, I feel like, more in that sense, because putting all those little pieces together has been fun. I concede the point to you, though, that, you know, it is a little bit more dense for just the first viewing, especially if you're not like you or I, where you have a lot of experience with all of these different comic books. You've got all of this comic book movie knowledge. And, you know, because of that, it can be easier for us to digest this stuff, because we're like, oh, I see what's going on here because it reminds me of this. You know, not everybody has that.
No, not everybody does. But again, to the point about Gunn keeping things moving, is ultimately it didn't matter for audiences because people have been receiving it. And again, a normie like my wife, she's not a nerd by any stretch. She loved it. She thought it was great. And it's like, so obviously it works. It works fine. I think that sometimes, you know, we lose sight of the fact that Siskel and Ebert were onto something when they did thumbs up and thumbs down. It should be okay just to do that, you know? And most people are that way. Did I like it? Did I not like it? They're not debating these finer points too much. And I'm keeping up with the movie and everything, obviously. It's just that I think that had the plan been less complex, it would have given
Absolutely.
The movie more time to be at rest with what I think is the real beautiful core of this movie, which is the chemistry between Corn Sweat and Brosnahan. I think that is your casting coup de grace for this film, is the Superman and Lois love story at the core of it works because those actors unlock the chemistry I wanted between Superman and Lois. That is a tough one to get. People think it's easy, but people think it's easy because we consider it a given that Superman and Lois are going to be falling in love with each other in one way or the
Agreed.
Other. Yeah. They actually made me believe they were a functional couple. That's not easy to do in a performance.
See, I completely agree with you. And I really want to jump into that. But there's something I feel like we kind of have to talk about before that. But I'm so glad you brought that up, because, I mean, I'm right on board with you. To me, those two together are the core of the film in many ways, because they are opposites, and yet they're making each other better people, actually, mm-hmm. by being together, which, you know, is such a beautiful thing to celebrate what relationships can do. So, but I wanted to ask you real quick before we dive into them, because I think it has a big part to play in that story, is this idea of parents, right?
Mm.
And one of the major changes that Gunn does make here is to the Els.
Yes.
And his Kryptonian heritage and what they wished for Clark. There are iterations in the comics, you know, Gunn knows of them, you know.
I know of them, and I'm not even the most steeped in the lore.
Yeah. So, but, you know, Byrne had made the Kryptonian homeworld much colder than previously experienced. You know, Smallville in 10 seasons gave us a Jor-El who kind of always had mixed motivations, even Wade's birthright. And, you know, so for them, they want Cal to rule the world, create a harem, and basically destroy anybody that gets in his way. And that's juxtaposed with the Kents, who are probably the most down-to-earth version of those characters we've ever seen.
Yes.
Kind of the, I would say, and I do not mean this derogatorily, but they are simple, salt-of-the-earth people who are as kind of good as you can get, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to ask you then about that juxtaposition that we create because of that change. And in the, and two, I mean, in the way in which that makes Clark embrace that human heritage
mm-hmm.
even more than he might have ever done before.
I like the fact that Gunn did this, because I know that if I felt the same way that the other people in the audience felt, it was the most subversive moment Gunn had in his arsenal to bring to this, which is the moment where when you first hear the rest of the message decoded about, you know, hey, we want you to rule the world. We sent you there so that you had the blah, 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 all that stuff. Your first gut reaction is Luther's, he made that up. That can't be true, because it's so ensconced in our brains that the Els were these marvelous people who only wanted their son to have a good, you know, blah, 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 blah. It's like, no, it's the Kents that wanted that for their son, because the Kents are who that is. I like that. It's a great switch. It's a great emotional beat to have to pull the rug out from under you. And I think it also very cleverly works with the audience. We all have the image of Donner Superman in our brains, and Gunn gets a shortcut to get that reaction out of us, because we don't ever expect the Els to be this way. And Gunn says, I'm not going to make the Els the way that you're used to. And yes, I agree to your point. It makes Superman more human, because it's that theme of, I mean, I love the fact that Pa Kent sits there and says, you know, basically it's not who you're born from, it's your choices. That's going to determine who you are. What a message. Like, there's so many messages in this movie where, like, I want to high five James Gunn, because I'm like, oh my Lord, the world needs... You talk about Lois and Clark, they're opposites, but they love each other. Ma and Pa Kent are not his birth parents, but they teach him your choices are what matters. He says to Luther, doesn't matter that I'm from another world. I'm a human being. I make the same mistakes you do, and I just try my best every day. Like, this movie is so jam-packed, and I think it gets all the way back to that. That's the core. Superman is Superman by choice, not because he has to be. And that's what is the most inspirational aspect of the character, is we are like Luther. We want to believe that if somebody had this power, they would be a bad person because they couldn't help themselves. And by making Superman more human, it makes his decision even more noble, because he wasn't given some otherworldly mandate to be a good dude. He chose to be a good dude, even though he had every possible opportunity and ability to be Luther.
I mean, he could be whatever he would want to be, and who's going to stop him? You know,
no one.
And I think you said it perfectly. And so the only thing I really feel like I can add to this is what's so fascinating to me about this movie is so much political discourse online, which is so stupid about this film, about this immigrant story and whatnot.
Oh my
but
God.
The beauty I found about this film is it came out of really what you just said, right? Clark chooses who he wants to be. And who Clark chooses to be is what his parents taught him to be and modeled for him in their own lives. You know, Paul Kent tells him, he's like, parents aren't for showing their kids, telling their kids what to be. They're for giving them the tools to make fools out of themselves all by themselves.
Yes.
And Clark is an immigrant who has acclimated to his new home and picked up those values and become the best version of what that place says it believes. Which, talk about an incredible story, because that is the story that so many people who specifically come to America do find, right? When they immigrate.
Yeah,
immigrate to our country.
Yeah, you're still who you are, but you understand how to, you know, grow as a person and all of that type of stuff. Like, and the thing is, the closest I think the movie ever really gets to, I mean, listen, there are a lot of charged things. The whole pocket universe thing, there's a very obvious, thing about how we treat prisoners and stuff. Like, there are definitely things to explore in this, but the only flat out in your face statement I think that is great is from Sean Gunn as Maxwell Lord on the screen at the end, where he says, I think conservatives and liberals can finally agree on something. Lex Luthor sucks. I laughed so hard.
Exactly.
I laughed
Me
so
too.
Hard at that.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, and I think this thing is really beautiful as well, is honestly, James Gunn is so subversive, I think, in the way in which he subtly sets up what's going to come next, which is Supergirl, right?
Yes.
And he's already said, look, as good as Clark is, in fact, the poster for Supergirl that comes out next year just came out today, and it says, instead of look up, it says look, and then it's crossed out the up, and it's spray painted out, look out, because Supergirl is a royal mess, which makes so much sense when she is a person who comes from Krypton, lived there, and then comes to Earth and has a completely different experience than Cal, who gets to be raised here and then,
right.
You know, really imbibe these values as his own. And so I think it's one of those things where, again, you know, so many people kind of got up in arms with the ways in which Snyder just challenged the character of Superman by asking some interesting questions. I think Gunn really does actually the same thing, right? He even talked about this in an interview. He's like, I had to figure out the things where I had to honor them as Superman, but then I had to figure out the ways in which I could challenge the character, but also help the character through that challenge by maybe making some changes.
You know,
what it means, I think, to understand, okay, I can't just kind of give people the same Superman they've ever seen. I need to give them something that makes coming to this movie worth it, right? And I think that's the thing Gunn was wrestling with. And I think this makes for a really interesting story because, again, by the end of the film, you have a Clark and a Superman who are embracing what it means to be human even more than we've ever seen before because of everything he's gone through with this revelation. And that's a fascinating thing to see Clark do.
Yeah. I mean, yes. Spot on. It, but again, I think Gunn buys himself by putting it as this is a part two without a part one. Gunn is able to hit fast forward on a couple of things and get to the point. And that's, look, we can bemoan it all that we want to. It's how we live now. We want to, let's just get to the point. And he gets to the point. And, you know, he does layer a lot of things that work really well. So I think you're spot on.
Yeah. Well, and I think this is the perfect place to really dive into the character of Superman and Clark, David Corn-Sweat's performance. And so first, I just wanted to start there the same way we did with Lex. What did you think of Corn-Sweat? Because obviously, as with any Superman movie, it is carried by the person who wears the shield. And so how did you think he did with the performance? Was it what you kind of hoped it would be? Was it what you wanted it to be? Did it surprise you in any way? What did you think?
I will say that Gunn is a very smart director, and I think that Corn-Sweat is a very gifted actor. And so I will sum it all up very briefly. I enjoyed Superman Returns, but one of its limitations was obviously Brandon Routh, was given the direction, play Christopher Reeve, and then we'll branch out with it in the next one, okay? Be Chris here. And your mileage may vary. And then, of course, we have a totally different one with Snyder, so let's leapfrog to this one. I think that what I love about Corn-Sweat's performance is he hits enough notes to make me recognize the Reeve-type aspects, but he does it in such a... he puts enough spin on it himself that I see a guy not imitating a previous actor's performance, but delivering a performance that is similar in tone and feel to one that really resonates, I think, with the character.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the thing I think that Corn-Sweat brings to this is that he just makes the character his. Like, for me, the beauty was, is I wasn't actually thinking of any of the other Supermen, the people who played him. I was just picking up what Corn-Sweat was laying down, you know? And, mm-hmm. and I think, you know, again, kind of having read a lot of comics, he felt like bits and pieces of all these different comics that I've read. And the beauty of, and this is the one thing, right, that the original Marvel movies from the phase one were doing, right, is they were being an amalgamation of a lot of the different comic book stories and versions of the character and kind of then making their own version, the mm-hmm. one that fits within the MCU. Corn-Sweat feels like he's basically doing the same thing with Superman, right? I mean, the beauty, I thought, of this was that this is a Clark who and a Superman who has kind of a temper. You know what I mean? When he goes storming into Lex's office about the dog, I mean, it feels like he's ready to rip somebody's head off in that moment. At the same time, you know, he's also the guy who's like, the only time Superman curses in this movie is the moment when he comes face to face with his own clone. And he's like, what the hell? It's the only time he curses, because every other time he's like, well, good gosh, you know, like he just sounds like, you know, what the hey, dude, right. You know, so.
But see, that's sort of the echo of the Reeve, like Christopher Reeve, like he left an everlasting imprint on the character. That's the type of echo of that Superman that I see in there. And
yeah,
I think
I can see that. Yeah,
I think that's very necessary, I think, for the character to have the broadest possible appeal. And that's what I applaud about it. And that's why I talked specifically about Ralph was trying to, he was given the direction to be too much like the previous version.
Yes.
Whereas Corn-Sweat absorbs and plays with those aspects that we love so much about it. Mm-hmm. But yes, to your point, makes it his own.
He's given room to breathe, to be himself.
Yes.
And to me, you were talking about this idea of the making your choices, right? And your choices really define who you are. Very Harry Potter, right? I was immediately thinking of the discussion that Dumbledore has with Harry in the books and in the movie. It's what our choices that are who define who we are more than anything else. But the coming out of this film, I think the thing that really stuck with me is that whole scene with Lois where, you know, she says, you know, we're so different. I mean, I'm suspicious of everyone, and you just think everybody is beautiful. And when you were saying that this is the movie that we all need, I think that there's something, you know, Superman has always kind of been seen as somewhat of a messiah figure, right? And the
again, thanks to 1978 in a large way.
Right. Well, but I mean, even, you know, it's being written by two Jewish guys who, you know, would love to see this person be able to make right the wrongs of the world. And so there's something so beautiful about her saying that, because Clark is basically saying, look, I see the imprint of God. I see the image of God in everybody, and that's how I see people. So then I treat them with kindness first. And you know, the whole thing, and I've seen it all over the place, you know, maybe kindness is the real punk rock.
Right.
Right? Maybe that's the thing. And to me, the idea that loving others and this beauty of, like, we live in a world that's so full of people who do nothing but navel gaze and look in. Mm-hmm. But this movie's tagline is look up. Maybe if we looked up and we just actually saw other people as people worthy of love, honor, and respect because they're made in the image of God, maybe this world would be a completely different place if we stopped looking down and started looking up.
Sure.
And there's just something so beautiful. And I'm sorry, I'm sermonizing right now, but this is the thing that really made me love this movie. Because like you said, Gunn is laying a lot of interesting things in here. But that's a message that just, like, it got me in this movie. And I thought it was the place where Superman became the film that we really do need right now. If film is important, this movie had something really truly important to say. And I got to give it to him. I think James Gunn did it really, really well.
I mean, honestly, I think we've been waiting for a movie with this type of, I mean, that specific exchange where she says, you know, and you think everybody is beautiful, and he says, maybe that's the real punk rock. Like, that's the type of exchange that we need. The pendulum swings, okay? You look at 70s movies and then 80s movies and then 90s, the pendulum swings in a certain way. And what I think is cool about this movie is it is overstuffed.
Yeah.
And it has everything it can possibly fit into an approximate 2-hour runtime. So it feels very much like a 90s superhero film. But it has this hopefulness that wasn't present in the 90s. The 90s superhero movies were overstuffed and cynical.
Yep.
They were tongue-in-cheek, and they treated it as kitsch, and they treated it as a silly, childish thing, and ha, 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 why do we even like these things? And then we overcorrected, and everything became too damn serious.
Yeah.
And then everything became too damn complex, and it's just like, oh, my God.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so now the pendulum, I hope that Superman is swinging us back toward that vibe of, oh, it's okay to have a character and a movie that moralizes with what you're talking about. Hey, stop absorbing all of this awfulness and stop turning on a dime on everybody. Like, it's very comic booky, but, you know, very simply, you know, related, but the whole idea that the crowd turns on him on a dime, like he's in the middle of a fight,
exactly.
And then it's like, oh, the story broke, and now everybody hates him. You could easily look at that and be like, that's not how the real world works.
100%.
Yeah, it totally is how the real world works now.
Exactly.
It's ridiculous. It's exactly how it works.
Well, and that's, again, the beauty of the things that Lex is doing, like to take Superman down, it all feels very real. And again, this is actually the place where there's a lot of mirroring with what Snyder was doing, which, you know, Snyder basically posits that question, you know, maybe he's not a messiah figure, maybe he's just a dude trying to do the right thing, right? And that is who this Superman is, which is he And this is the other thing that got to me, because that whole conversation with Lex at the end, where he's like, that's where you've always been wrong. He's literally just a guy trying to do the next right thing. And he doesn't always get that right, but his goal, just do the next right thing. Well, then after that, just do the next right thing.
Yeah, I think Gunn also, with his with the whole social media thing, I really think Gunn's working out some demons about what happened to him.
Oh, yes. 100%.
There is,
and that, as he kind of should, right?
God, no, but God love him. You know, you're supposed to write what you know, and this has definitely the aura of somebody who's been through the ringer and had everything about him misinterpreted for malicious purposes, and it almost cost him everything. Like, yeah, bravo, Mr. Gunn. You got a platform that most people don't get to have to stand up and say, I got treated like garbage, and you people who treated me that way are garbage too.
Yeah.
Thanks for your $15. Enjoy the show. Like, I applaud it. And it's one of those things where I hope it won't. We can't. We're all addicted to social media and everything. We get it. Mm-hmm. Okay. And our phones and all that type of stuff. I'm not going to be so Pollyanna to be like, oh, people are going to walk out and they're going to understand. But maybe this is just a little seed that people can start nurturing to grow into something more substantial about, hey, when you read that thing, maybe give it a second. Maybe not react right away. Maybe think it through.
Yep. Well, and I think the interesting thing about this is a great time to kind of jump into Rachel Brosnahan's Lois Lane, right? First, we've got to talk about, I think, her performance, because for me, I think that she does a wonderful job of portraying this character who is very much a juxtaposition between her and Superman, of being somebody who is jaded, who questions everything, who does not see the world the way that he does, because you can tell she's had a different growing up experience, right? That has led her to be much more cynical and placed her in a position where you can tell she does want to be able to believe, and her relationship with Clark is helping her to be able to do that. But she's still always going to be somebody who's kind of questioning. And I thought she was great. And she just embodies the best of what I think, to me, Lois Lane is kind of supposed to be, which is a challenge for Clark and Superman, right? By asking him good questions. But at the same time, she's just so freaking likable and enjoyable. I mean, the whole conversation she's having with Mr. Terrific about, like, you know, I was just dating him and I was going to break up with him, but then he told me he loved me. And it's like, she feels also very much like a real person.
I'm going to be very caustic here. I haven't watched everything that's ever been released about Superman, so I will restrict my comments to the major feature films. But of the major feature films, Rachel Brosnahan is the best Lois Lane and best love interest.
Wow.
That has been in a Superman film.
Okay.
I'm not taking anything away from Amy Adams, but I don't think Amy Adams was given much of an opportunity to be charming in those movies. Like, she's Amy Adams, so she's charming when she walks on screen. Okay. But, like, I think that Rachel Brosnahan is, of the major big budget feature Superman movies, the best Lois Lane, period.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I mean, you heard it here, folks. John Mills. And I
operate under the count at Matt Rushing 02.
Send I'm actually not going to disagree with you. I think she's wonderful. And in many ways, I don't know if you ever watched Superman and Lois, but she was also a fantastic Lois Lane. And of course, that's a different Superman. I mean, he's married to her at that point. They have two kids and all. But
I didn't watch that. And that's why I restricted my comments to, I've seen all of the movies, including Superman 4. So,
well, and again, too, one of the things you mentioned is that she does such a great job of being the love interest for Corn Sweat. in the sense, and them being love interests for one another. They, like you mentioned, their relationship feels real. Their chemistry is real. And you need that because you need them to be able to sell very quickly that they've been in a relationship for 3 months and that they have these feelings for one another that are growing. And I think that they do a superb job of doing that together. And that's just as much on Brosnahan as it is Corn Sweat to pull off. And so to me, like, I'm so thankful that he chose her as this Lois Lane.
Yes.
Because I'm so excited actually to see not just where Superman goes next, but I'm excited to see where Lois Lane is going to go next in this DCU. And, you know, and then of course where their relationship grows together.
Agreed. I think she's a secret weapon in this movie. I think this movie has a couple of secret weapons and I think she's one of them.
Well, is one of your secret weapons also Crypto? Because this is the first time we've seen him in live action. And so talk me through your thoughts on bringing him into this universe. And I will say, maybe one of the hardest, I mean, other than Superman shooting a mini Superman out of his hand, a super dog is one of the most difficult things to, I think, try to bring to life in the comics. And so, walk me through that, man.
Giant cellophane S in Superman 2. That one was, I rolled with that
also
one.
Also difficult. I rolled with that also one. Difficult.
Nuclear Man growing his fingernails super long, super fast, and scratching Superman. That's a hard one to take into.
Yeah.
I think Crypto is a great way because you have the opening words set this very somber sort of like, oh, Superman just suffered his first defeat. There's all of this stuff. And then we immediately go into the dog being silly. And it immediately disarms you as an audience. It's like, it's cool. We're going to be tempering things. But I think that Crypto is maybe overused a little bit in the movie. But is primarily used to great effect because this dog feels real. As silly as it sounds to say that. And I think anybody who has had a dog as a pet, I mean, the scene that got the biggest laugh from me was the world is tearing itself apart. All of this stuff is going on and he whistles for Crypto. And where is Crypto? Crypto is in a pet store eating every last treat that is in there.
Fantastic.
That was incredibly relatable for those of us who have dogs who are also impossible to train.
Yeah.
I think it's such a whimsical, fun thing. And I think it also firmly reminds you throughout the movie that this is a living comic book. More than any other comic book movie in recent history, this is a living comic book. If I was flipping through a Superman comic and I saw Crypto doing these things, I would say, okay, that's Crypto doing those things. And it's just, it allows me to play along with the gag, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
Like, and it just makes it go down easier, I guess. And so I think Crypto is wonderful. I love Crypto as a character in this. I hope you do too.
No. Okay. You know, and I'm not a dog person. I'm not an animal person in general at all. And so, yes, you can at me at Kessel Junkie. But, you know, it's, I thought that Crypto was utilized perfectly in this film. And the reason for that is the way in which, at the end of the movie, it's another place where Clark is and Superman is shown to be very smart, right? There's a couple things at the end of the film where we show him to be smart. One is his battle with the engineer and Ultraman, where he takes them all the way up to space and then drops down, realizing he's going to be able to survive, that the engineer will not be able to. Incredibly smart on his part. And then the other part is that realizing that Lex has tried to map out every scenario of what's going to happen, right? Every little, it's like his prescience of trying to understand Superman. But what hasn't he factored in? The fact that Clark has a dog.
Yep.
And so there's that moment of Clark realizing, yeah, you lost because I'm going to call the dog in and he's going to ruin your fun. And it's a beautiful moment, right? And that's the moment where Krypto, who, you know, has been annoying Clark the whole movie as well, and maybe the audience shows up and is a true hero. And then I also thought the beauty of this was that the whole movie, you're kind of like, come on, Clark would have a much better behaved dog, right? Like, Clark would have been a good dog trainer. But then to know that this is Kara's dog, and Kara is a mess, and then you see her with the dog at the end, and it's like, okay, everything, again, Gunn sets this all up, and then it pays off. Like, it's like Chekhov's right. dog. And he utilizes that to great effect because it lets us know something about a character who's going to spend like 30 seconds on screen. And I loved that. And so in that, I really have to ask you, what did you think about the fact that Kara shows up for that cameo, which sets up the fact that, you know, Supergirl is where we go next. And it's not like, hey, this is where we're going next. It's more like, oh, well, we've already seen all these other characters, so right. it just kind of makes sense we'd see another one.
I think that it's the best way you could have introduced Supergirl as an option in this universe. And immediately, by having spent all of this time with her ill-behaved dog, and then see the interaction at the end, yeah, I already know this character. And so yeah. I've gotten to your point, a 30-second introduction. I thought it was fun. And I think also it was great because, yeah, you sit there the whole time. You're like, how could Clark possibly have a dog this ill-behaved?
Yeah.
And then you see the dog's, you know, the dog's owner. And, okay, yeah, that makes sense. You know, like, I got it. So, yeah, I think you said it perfectly. It's like it was a great way to bring Kara in without making it feel forced. It felt organic.
No, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. And in that, it's one of those places where, you know what, to me, there probably are a couple places where I'd feel like you could probably remove some characters, it would be fine. But this was a place where inserting Krypto really helped you in that way. And Gunn, I felt like, had truly just kind of thought about the ramifications. Okay, what does this look like? How do I do this well? And, you know, my wife does this thing where she's watching a movie or whatever, and I know she's really liking something as she does this little chuckle that she does.
Mm-hmm.
And she did that chuckle so many times when Krypto was on screen. And it's like, I know she's loving what she's watching if she does that. And like that first scene where, like, from the movie where he's like dragging his leg up. We've seen the movie. We saw the movie twice together. Both times she chuckled in that moment.
Well, the thing is, I think this is worth pausing to point out as well, is this is why, like, basically at the end of the movie, without, like, very subtly, he puts it into your brain as to exactly why Lex Luthor failed to take Krypto into account, because he's not Superman's dog. Luthor would have planned on Krypto.
Yep.
If Krypto were Superman's dog. But the fact is that Clark fortunately happened to be dog sitting at the worst possible moment for Lex. Like, that's really efficient storytelling. Well done.
Yep. Yeah. Dog sitting ruins the day, man.
Yeah, exactly.
So, look, I think we could talk about a lot of different characters with the Daily Planet. This is probably the only place where I feel like you probably inserted too many characters, but in some ways it more felt like Gunn saying, hey, this is the Superman world. This is who inhabits his world. But Jimmy Olsen actually does get a very large role to play in this film, unlike many of the other iterations of Jimmy Olsen. I mean, apparently Jimmy Olsen is a god among women. Who knew? And so I just wanted to ask you about his performance, what they give him to do, and the way in which kind of Gunn utilizes him in a way that we've never really seen Jimmy Olsen utilize before.
I love what Gunn does with him, and I've been a fan of this actor ever since I encountered him on The Righteous Gemstones. I think he's great. He's got great on-screen charisma. I think he's very slick. I think he's very, he plays the character extremely well. I believe that Jimmy is so clueless that he doesn't understand his magnetism. Like, Jimmy doesn't understand his magnetism the same way we don't understand his magnetism. We're like, what's going on? And he's like, I don't know why. Why? Yeah. And like, I love the fact that it's Lex Luthor's girlfriend that's in love with Jimmy Olsen.
Fantastic.
I'm like, that's the... See, that's the sort of unbridled imagination that I think has been missing from movies for so long. Yeah. Oh, look, let's be honest. That's what made Guardians such a thrill. That's why that suddenly changed the course of all of the MCU afterward. Is you look at MCU prior to Guardians and post-Guardians, it's two different universes. Gunn changed the course of the MCU. And I think that here he takes some of his better... impulses and puts them to good use here. And I didn't like his Suicide Squad. I've been very open about that.
Right.
And yeah. I
do want to go back and rewatch at this point just to see, but because I haven't seen it since it came out. I saw it once.
He was trying really hard, and I think he just didn't have the characters he needed. I think he's a little hamstrung in the Suicide Squad.
Agreed. Yeah.
And here, I think he's got that freedom again to be like, I know my main characters here and I know how to support them. So I think he's got more freedom here as to what he's trying to accomplish. And he also, I don't want to talk about the Suicide Squad, like probably ever again.
Yeah.
But like, this is, Gunn's better impulses, are given free rein here. So.
Yeah. Obviously, this is a film in which Superman is not the only hero. We have another group of heroes, a gang, you might call them, a Justice Gang. That's not really their name, just a test name.
Isn't that in and of itself that's like a deep dive comic gag too?
I think
that's a reference right there because there was a title that was Justice Gang, and I think like. It wasn't a long-lived title, but like I was like, wait a minute, I think he just made another...
As it shouldn't be, because, not really the... Anyway, but this group is actually funded by Maxwell Lord, and who we get a brief glimpse of, of course, played by Sean Gunn with the great line that we mentioned earlier. We got Nathan Fillion as Guy Gardner, and we've got Eddie Gathegi, I think that's how you say his last name, so, forgive me if it's wrong, and Isabella Merced as Hawkgirl, as the three other characters that really, and I think in many ways, kind of juxtapose themselves against Superman to show how his heroism is different. What did you think of these three and their introduction in here and how they're utilized in the film and their performances?
I thought it was great. I thought it was also, why aren't they the heroes and stuff like that? You instantly set up that the Justice Gang are like a mercenary group, because that's sort of the thing. It's like, they're Maxwell Lord's group. It's like, wait, what? So it's like, it's almost like Luthor is a rival billionaire to Lord. And it's like, so Luthor's using all of his technology to play in this world of metahumans, whereas Lord just hires out metahumans. And it's like, that's kind of cool. Like I said earlier, my wife has no idea who the hell Guy Gardner is. Not at all.
Yeah.
But she loved him. I think actually Mr. Terrific is low-key been stealing the show for a lot of people.
Seriously.
Really great stuff.
Legit. Yes.
Some of the best moments in the movie are him.
Yeah.
And I think, Hawkgirl, it's a tough character to play and a tough character to get to play for audiences. They pull it off. And then, who outside of the most absolutely diehard comics fans even would know of characters who, can make matter out of anything? Like, that's such a deep dive character That's like going into Marvel and like bringing matter eating lad onto the big screen. It's like, if you're a, if you're a diehard comic book fan, you're like, even if you don't know the character, you're like, yeah, that, that, that sounds about right. You know, like it's one of those things. And so I thought they were all great. I thought they were all, they didn't steal the show, but they really enhanced the movie. I think they were real enhancements for the movie.
No, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. In that, I think the thing that really was super fun about them, all pun intended, was the fact that they did help us be able to see that Superman does stand apart in his heroism. And then on top of that, I mean, like you said, I mean, Mr. Terrific is just phenomenal. That whole scene, and yes, Gunn likes to do this in his films where he has that kind of 360 moment in the action. But him doing it was just, it's so good. And then, you know, Lois just being holy, and you're right. I mean, look, we don't really learn anything about Hawkgirl. I'm sure we will in future films, but she's cool in the film. And then, you know, Nathan Fillion just basically getting to be himself and having the worst hairdo ever is awesome. And he plays it to perfection. And you know, I mean, I think all of us knew that that casting was going to be perfect for the character of Guy Gardner, because Guy Gardner is kind of a character in the comics you hate anyway.
He's a total D-bag.
Exactly. And knowing that the Lantern show that's going to be coming out on HBO Max with all of those Green Lantern characters, I can't wait for now, because he's part of it. So
yes.
It makes me very excited.
You mentioned the show. He threw in Peacekeeper. I haven't watched that show.
Yeah, I haven't either. And the second season is actually supposed to be the thing that kind of helps us bridge from the DCEU to the DCU. So it kind of makes me think I should go and watch the first season so I can also watch the second season
I'm nervous about that, though.
Same.
I feel like Peacekeeper should only, I feel like the amount of Peacekeeper I should ever see is this scene.
I kind of agree with you on that. But yeah.
Was he in the Suicide Squad? Yes. He was. Yeah.
So
yeah, that
one key
stands.
Moment there, right? Just him being in there when he's on that talk show. You know, he talks about the idea that like Superman, you know, he's frustrated because Superman will only kill somebody if it's absolutely necessary. Which I was like, interesting. So we have already set up that there is, and Gunn has talked about this in an interview. There could be a place where Superman could be forced to kill people in this universe if he felt like there was no other way and he was saving lives to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, I just find that fascinating.
Which is a thing that threw everybody on. Yeah, I know. Yep, at the end of Man of Steel, everybody had a hissy fit about. I know.
We have to talk about this film in the sense that this is truly Action Comics. This film is maybe the most comic booky movie I've ever seen when it comes to comic book films, other than the Into the Spider-Verse films that literally feel like moving comic books.
Yes.
I mean, everything about this movie just feels like you're reading a trade paperback, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to ask you about the action, the effects, the fights, kind of seeing Superman win, seeing Superman lose, the effects overall, the fortress, we can talk about the production value, the costumes. What in this movie hit you that you really liked? Was there anything you didn't? I mean, maybe emptying cities in 5 minutes is a little bit ridiculous, but you know, it's neither here nor there.
It's going to seem silly. It's going to seem really, really silly. But the moment that really captured my heart, because it just was so silly in so many ways, but felt so much like a comic book, was Superman saving the squirrel.
I knew you were going to say that.
I laughed with glee because it's such It's such a little moment that I can see it drawn as panels of the big fight going on in the background, and the squirrel was there, and then Superman snatches up the squirrel before he gets back to the fight, because it's like, I'm trying to minimize everything. Like, that feels great, because the thing is, we all love and expect the heroic, I'm sheltering the girl while all the stuff flies by, or I'm holding the beast's leg up so the woman can run out of the way, or I'm holding up the building. I love him holding up the building so the woman can drive away, right? And not like yelling at her to go. He's just like looking at her like, just get moving, please.
Whenever you got a moment.
When you feel ready.
I'm holding up a building here.
When you feel ready.
Fine.
But yeah, and I think that Gunn knowing what he wants is helpful for the effects. Now, the thing is, I will acknowledge, as much as I'm effusively praising everything, I hear / read the criticisms that are coming out about it being too comic booky or about it feeling stitched together. I get that. The same way, even though I came around on a lot of the Snyder stuff, I hear those complaints and I'm like, okay, I get it. And that's fair. You know, there can be plenty of things, but yeah, like again, it's that unbridled sense of fun. It doesn't matter to me whether this is Superman or not. I know I've nitpicked movies like this one to death, but a lot of it is made up for by the fact that the production value is so slick, is so good overall. Overall, there are effects that are a little bit too ambitious, and there are things that look like they are effects that are swapped in really fast because they decided to change something. It's true of any movie nowadays. But I think overall, you know, Gunn knows what he wants and he got it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just effects wise, all the fights, everything, I think all of that was incredibly fun and well done. And one of the things that stuck out to me, and I was thinking about as I watched the film and I've just been thinking about it, you know, over really the last week now, I think one of the things that has helped most James Gunn movies is that, and we've talked about this many times, you don't have to have the best effects, but really you need consistent effects.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie has very consistent effects, I thought. So I wasn't in any moment truly drawn out of a scene because that effect shot looked so much different than the previous one. There was a real synergy between all of the effect shots. And so I thought that was great, you know, and I loved the interpretation of the forest and I loved the interpretation of the fortress and the kind of the Silver Age giving Superman robots that, you know, help him out in the fortress. I thought that was all fun. I originally, and you know this, we talked about it many times behind the scenes on the other side of the bar, not a huge fan of the costume originally. And on screen, they really won me over. I think they did a great job with that. In fact, I also kind of loved the explanation of just the kind of sameness almost for the Justice Gang costumes, you know, in the fact that, you know, they're all made by a corporate entity, you know, so they feel very corporate in that sense.
Yeah.
You know, and so I'm really interested in what they do going forward because Gunn has said, you know, that you may see superheroes from one movie to the next in a different costume, you know, like you do in a lot of comic books themselves. So I enjoyed that. And I thought that was all really well done, actually. And I will say, honestly, the best costume in the movie was Supergirl. She walked on screen and looked just like Supergirl that I expect to show up in the comics.
Yeah.
And it was like, you nailed it. And so, yeah, to me, I think that was probably one of my favorite aspects of this film is that it feels like an issue of Action Comics, you know, where it's just kind of off the wall, bonkers, you never know what's going to happen panel to panel, You don't necessarily know who's going to show up panel to panel because that's the way comics work. And Gunn just kind of has embraced that in this film. And people seem to be responding to that and having a good time at a comic book movie again, which, you know, hasn't happened in quite a while.
Well, I like the I like Superman's outfit because it looks like an outfit. I know how simple that seems to say, but it looks like an outfit that he puts on. And I'm glad that they didn't use the sort of Speedo look that is most famous with Superman on screen. That's okay with me.
Yeah, like I'm glad that they did not go with, 100% with,
you know, so,
with the Superman Returns look. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm good with this. It looks like an outfit that somebody would put together that would be comfortable and functional. And so I'm good with that. And I thought that honestly, you know, if you're going to talk about costuming, the costuming for Eve is on point. The costuming for Luther is perfect. Like, I thought the costuming was absolutely top notch in this film.
Yeah.
I really do.
Yeah. Well, yes, I agree. You know, it just felt right. It really felt like that the costume designer and Gunn had spent a lot of time talking about each character so that what they were wearing said a lot about them, you know. And, you know, I know a lot has been made of the fact that Corin Sweat and Gunn talked back and forth about the trunks. And honestly, they were going to do this film without them. And I believe they said it was like the day before shooting or whatever, and Corin Sweat said, look, maybe Superman wears the trunks so he looks a little bit silly, and it makes it people, you know, easier to accept him. You know,
yeah, it makes him less threatening to kids,
exactly,
I think he said.
Which you actually saw in the film when all the kids run up to him and he's giving them a hug, you know, and giving them high fives and stuff, and making sure they're okay. It's like, yeah, I think it worked. And in all honesty, I've ordered the Hot Toys toy with Crypto, so I can't wait for it to arrive. So,
there you go.
So Superman is famous for his theme, and that is because John Williams gave us one of the most incredible themes in all of cinema history for this character. And stepping into the shoes, the very large red boots of John Williams are John Murphy and David Fleming. And I have to ask you how you felt like they handled the music, because we have already seen somebody do this before with Superman Returns, and John Ottman's score, which has been universally praised as an incredible score and maybe one of the best films to actually utilize somebody else's themes and at the same time bring it forward a little bit, because Ottman also created his own themes to go along with Superman Returns. So regardless of my feelings of that film, I would agree. I think it's actually one of the best that's ever been done, next to somebody like, say, John Powell doing Solo, or
that's the one I immediately go to. I'm like, actually, the gold standard for me is John Powell with Solo.
I liked Giacchino's work in Rogue One, and so there are people who have played with Williams themes before and made it their own. How did these guys do? And did the score give you that sense of kind of wonder that, you know, you would hope for in a brand new Superman film?
It feels like an extension of Williams's work, but not necessarily in a positive way. Now, keep in mind, you use Williams's theme. It is a shortcut to emotion for me 100% of the time. Like every right-thinking person on Earth, I love that theme. And you use it, and it is an emotional cheat in a lot of ways. I will immediately be on board. I've told this story before. When I saw Superman Returns for the first time, I had no idea whether they were going to use the Williams theme or not. And then when it opened up that way, my friend Joey was sitting next to me, and he would be able to tell you, I started giggling. And I went, yeah. I was so happy that they stuck with the theme. With this, I feel like they box themselves in a way, because they use the theme, but not to its full extent. Like they don't evolve it so much as lean on it. And while it works, it doesn't make it, you know, I think you either have the choice to do what Ottman did, or you have the choice to do what Zimmer did, which was, screw it, I'm throwing everything out and I'm doing my own thing and I'm going to beat your eardrums to death. This, I think, feels like it's caught in between. And so it works, but I don't think it's really its own work, if that makes sense.
If there's really any criticism that I have of the film, it is the score. I think that they're of two minds. They never actually utilize the full theme. And I think that's a disservice to the theme. If you're going to use it, just go whole hog, man.
Exactly.
And I think the other thing that I don't really appreciate about what they do is it's like they're straddling the fence between Williams and Zimmer. You know, I think you were talking about that there. And it's like you want to have that kind of almost synth kind of sound that Zimmer does so well. And you want to kind of have the beauty of Williams, right, is the man knew how to use brass.
Mm-hmm.
And too many composers these days have no idea how to use brass. They only know how to use strings and synth. And it makes the music feel hollow.
Yeah, a bit.
Instead of full and rich. I mean, that's John Williams. One of the reasons he loves the French horn is because it does that. And so I think that's what the movie is missing, is that feeling of like richness and fullness that I would want. And look, it's not the worst score I've ever heard, but it's also just, it's not the best that this can have. And I wish that if they're going to utilize the theme, which I get, because you're saying basically, hey, we're just going to recognize this, that this is the Superman theme. James Bond wouldn't change his theme. Mission Impossible doesn't change its theme. Superman shouldn't change his theme. Okay, that's fine. But then use it to its full effect.
Right.
The same way you would in a James Bond score. I mean, Thomas Newman in his scores for Bond did that. David Arnold, fantastic at that.
Yes.
Whether you even liked those films at all or not. So, quickly, I do have to ask you, you know, it's James Gunn. You're going to get some needle drops in a movie. And the biggest one there is, of course, the scene with Mr. Terrific. The song is 5 years time with Noah and the Whale. What did you think of utilizing that as well as the, you know, Iggy Pop singing at the end with, you know, I'm a punk rocker.
Perfect. Both of those. Perfect. That's all I can say. I think they're perfect.
Yeah. I couldn't agree with you more. I thought when he chose to do a needle drop, it fit perfectly, and it fit the vibe again of this movie and everything. So I only have one last question for you. Just as this, we know this is setting up a DCU. We know a few things that are coming. We know that we're going to be getting Supergirl next year. And so that comes out in July. We're also going to be getting the Green Lantern show coming out on HBO Max. And we also know we're going to be getting Peacemaker Season 2, which is going to play into this universe. And we're getting a Clayface horror film.
I'm so on board with that. I'm so freaking on board with that. I can't even say. Sorry. Just had to say it. Yes.
No. I mean, coming out of this film, how do you feel about this? Because one of the key things that Gunn has said is this. We are not creating a master 10-year plan and then slavishly, you know, chaining ourselves to it. We have ideas of where we want to go, but the key is that if the script is ready and the script is good, that's what gets made next. And that's why we're getting actually Supergirl next year, is because the script came in, they thought it was phenomenal, and they're like, we have to make this film. This is next. And so with all of that, how are you feeling coming out of Superman and you know, getting into this new universe?
I'm on board. I honestly, and with the quote you just said with Gunn, he's sending as many signals as possible to say, I've learned all of the mistakes that have trapped Marvel. I'm not, and he's doing it the exact right way. I'm not doing a corporate 10-year plan. I have an idea. It's like any great filmmaker. I got to give myself room to change. And styles are going to change and tastes are going to change. We've got to be able to adapt along the way. We've got to play jazz. Yeah, I'm absolutely on board with it. I'm based on this and based on Gunn's approach to it and based on the projects that are coming out, I am like, if you were to compare, which comic book universe are you excited for? This one. Marvel's dead to me. Look, I don't care who needs to hear it. Yeah. I will grab you by the collar. I will slap you in the face. Marvel's dead. Okay. Let it go. It's over. Okay. Marvel lost its mojo and it's never going to get it back the same way, guys. That's okay. Marvel had its day. It had its impact. Now it can just run in the background. This is the way of the future. And I think it's a good looking future.
Yeah. No, I agree in that sense that you know, like you mentioned, and really well said, Gunn has just learned the lessons. And, you know, one of the things that Gunn mentioned when it came to Superman is, like, he said, look, I've always wanted to make this movie. And so I felt like I had to make this movie. And when it came to doing Superman, that, you know, when he first came in, they actually asked him to do a Superman movie and he didn't want to do it. He's like, I don't know how to do that yet. I don't know how to make it right to feel right for me. So he did Suicide Squad instead, which was a cop out. I think he was even kind of talked about that idea because he kind of knew how to do that. And then as he thought about it more and more and more, this movie just kind of percolated in his mind. He's like, I have to make this, you know? And I think that's the thing that's kind of been lost in this whole idea of making superhero films. We have to stop making movies because we can. We need to start making movies because we have to, as the creator. Like, I have to make this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, that's what drove George Lucas to do Star Wars. And you know, all the best creators, they have to make a film because it's just like, if I don't get this out of me, I'm going to explode, basically. And that seems to be kind of the lesson that we're getting in many ways with the DCU here. And I hope that it continues that way. Because for me, this is a win because they decided to do it that way. And quickly, the end credit stuff doesn't try to set anything up. They're not trying to make any false promises. It's basically just a thing like, hey, if you enjoyed the movie, here's a fun scene here. If you still enjoyed the movie because you sat through all the credits, here's just another little fun scene. Just hope you enjoyed it.
It's the same idea as what the old movies like Cannonball Run used to do, which is like, hey, we'll get you to watch the credits. Here's a couple of outtakes. It doesn't impact anything outside of just giving you a couple more minutes with what you liked. Enjoy it.
It just reminds me, like, so many times it feels like comic book movies these days are Clogsworth in Beauty and the Beast. There's always flowers, chocolates, promises you don't intend to keep, you know? And that's become comic book movies. And Gunn is specifically saying, we're not doing that to you.
Yep.
Which I thank him for. And so, look, thank you, as always, John, for sitting with me and talking Superman. I think, you know, we've had a blast over the years doing this. And so it was just great to sit down and talk with a friend about one of our favorite characters.
Agreed.
But where are you then in the ratings for this? Because honestly, most of our conversation, we've had a few asides, but there's really been nothing but mostly effusive praise. And so What is the brass tacks? How many Superman shields are you giving this?
Now, I dropped some criticisms along the way here.
You did. We both did actually. So it wasn't like this was a perfect film for us.
Not by any stretch. Like I said, I understand the criticisms that it's getting from some quarters. I will point out that if you use CinemaScore as any sort of barometer of the four that the CinemaScore site returns that were Superman movies. So that's Superman 4, Superman Returns, Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice. Now, obviously, this doesn't include Man of Steel, so let me look that up really quick. Man of Steel. CinemaScore didn't return it. So I'll just say anything that has the word Superman in it, in the Superman, this comes back with the highest mark of those four movies I mentioned. And so obviously, it's resonating with audiences. I recognize the shortcomings. It is very, very stuffed full of stuff. Luther's arc could have been done better. But at its core, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. I would say that this is probably a 3.5. But because it generated so much goodwill in my heart by the end of it, I'm going to give it a 4.
Oh, man, that's awesome. No, I love it. So the funny thing was about this film is it literally dropped on my birthday. And so this is my favorite superhero character. And going into it, you know, we had talked about it, and I'm like, I need to like this movie because I can't not like this movie and it be on my birthday. Like, it just can't happen, right? And I really love this film, and there are certain parts of it that I would change maybe or whatever, but I had such a great time in it. And I have enjoyed watching it all three times, and I actually kind of hope I get a chance to see it again maybe. Just because I really enjoyed the theater experience with it. And it's been fun to actually see it in the theater where people are clapping and kind of cheering in different moments. And to see people just enjoying my favorite character mm-hmm. along with me it's a great experience. I was at a 4.5, but I'm going to give this a 5.
Wow.
Because it's not, again, it's not perfect, right? And 5-star movies don't have to be perfect movies. They just Agreed. Have to be movies that you love watching and you know you're going to watch over and over again. I can't wait to get this movie at home. I can't wait to watch it again. I can't wait to have friends over to watch it with us, my wife and I. And I can't also wait to see what's going to come next. And in all honesty, I felt the same way coming out of Man of Steel. I loved that movie, and I couldn't wait to see what came next. And so I'm just glad that I'm loving Superman again, and that, you know, we get to enjoy it. So,
and I'll just say, I don't know, internet connection or something, but CinemaScore did return Man of Steel for me. Man of Steel and Superman 2025 were both A-. That's the best ratings of Crazy, any Superman right? movie tracked by CinemaScore
yeah.
outside of Donner's 1978.
And as we mentioned, look, that as we're recording this, we're recording on a Wednesday after the movie came out last week, and it has recorded the best Monday and the best Tuesday of the year.
Yeah, word and of so mouth is carrying this.
Yeah. So, well, we hope you enjoyed the show. And John, if maybe people want to catch up with you, maybe they want to talk Superman with you and what maybe some of your favorite runs are of the series or trade paperbacks maybe they should pick up or maybe just their favorite parts of the film. Where would they find you?
Just look for Castle Junkie. That's who I am. I'm most active, honestly, on Letterboxd, where I just basically log the movies that I watch, and I play coy. If I'm going to record about a movie, I won't put the star rating until afterward I record. And, of course, you can find me over on the Nerd Party Network, co-hosting two shows. One of them is House Lights with Darren Moser and Tristan Riddell, where we talk about the works of directors, and I threaten both of them from time to time, which is my favorite part of the show, honestly. And then, of course, I also co-host Aggressive Negotiations with you, Matthew Rushing.
And you can find me all over social media under the name MattRushing02. So whether it's Letterboxd or X Twitter or any of those places, just look me up. You'll find me there. You can also, of course, find me here on the network with a bunch of Star Trek talk with Chris Jones as we are about to actually be diving into the Strange New Worlds universe again. Because, hey, as we're recording this, the next day, the premiere comes out, and Chris and I will be talking about that next week. And of course, you can check out our Star Trek Voyager talk, or The Orb with Star Trek Deep Space Nine, or Warp 5 with Star Trek Enterprise. Of course, you also find me over on the Nerd Party Network when I wasn't talking about Star Wars with John Mills on Aggressive Negotiations. I was doing a Harry Potter podcast with Dre Kaufman as we talked about every single chapter of that series. And as most people probably know, there's a brand new series coming out with that on HBO Max in the next year or so. But good golly, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us. And y'all come back now, you hear? ¶¶